Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to my debut as Charlie Rhodes, because it is all about me, after all. This is actually a bit of a tough crowd. I want to begin by welcoming all of you and thanking all of you for coming, and to take a minute just to tell you about how we're going to try to lay out this evening.
Who are you?
One step at a time, guys.
In a few minutes, I'm going to introduce our guest, who's then going to spend about 10 minutes talking about what drove him to write this book, The Unmaking of Israel, and the central thrust of the argument. And then we're going to have a conversation that will proceed on two levels. I will be asking Gershom questions, and there are also index cards going around where people who have questions should write them on index cards, and they'll be collected over time by Ariel.
If you need one, just raise your hand.
And we will be weaving my questions with people's questions and hopefully have a rich conversation tonight.
Really? Who are you?
My name is Shai Held. I am the founder and chair in Jewish thought at Machon Hadar. And this is Gershom Gorenberg. Gershom Gorenberg, who I imagine most of you are here to see, and you know who he is, but I will say just a few sentences. Gershom is a journalist and historian who has lived in Israel since 1977. He is the author of three books under his own name. The first one is a study called The End of Days, which is about the role of religious extremism in the Middle East conflict. The second book, called The Accidental Empire, is an attempt to answer the question of how did the whole enterprise of settlements in Israel begin? It grew out of, interestingly, a career of being a reporter reporting on settlements and wanting to understand more deeply where they came from, how they emerged, and how they became such a central part of Israeli life and politics. And this latest book, The Unmaking of Israel, which you can purchase at the front door, is really an attempt to explore those policies and decisions that Israel has made that Gershom feels have caused a real threat to Israel's democracy, and maybe it's not so far to say a real threat to Israel's continued existence. And it ends not just with a kind of analysis, but with Gershom's prescription of what should Israel do next in order to avert the disaster he sees coming. I'll add just very briefly that Gershom is a correspondent for the American Prospect. He's written for magazines like the New York Times Magazine, the New York Review of Books, the Atlantic Monthly, really one of the most influential Israeli journalists, and certainly one of the most influential Israeli journalists writing for the English-speaking world. So I'm going to turn it over to Gershom, who will begin by telling us a little something about the journey towards this book and the argument that this book makes. Thank you, and welcome, Gershom.
Thank you. So, first of all, my thanks. Thank you, Shai, and to Machon Hadar for having me this evening. This is the first event at which I'm speaking about this book, and this is a wonderful place, a very comfortable place to begin. I could say that I started writing this book 25 years ago when Yehuda Litani, who was then the Middle East editor at the Jerusalem Post, when the Jerusalem Post was a newspaper, asked a young reporter who had a kippah and a beard that was then dark to start reporting on the settlements on the assumption, which turned out to be correct, that settlers would speak more easily to a religious Jew. And I don't know if it was only as a result of that, but at least partly as a result of that request that I began covering settlements, the interaction of politics and religion, the West Bank, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has been difficult. It has been satisfying. It involves doing what I brought with me from America as a 21-year-old Oleh that I'd learned in my fifth-grade civics class, that the press should raise the hard issues and provide information so that people can think about them and live with the people fact that many people will not be happy in hearing about what you have to say. that is the price of muckraking, is that there's muck often getting thrown at you. More immediately, 3 to 4 years ago, I began to see more and more evidence on the rising role of the religious right in the Israeli army. An increased number of officers and combat soldiers who were graduates of religious academies and settlements, and a rising degree of concern about the question of what they would do in a conflict between military orders and the authority of their rabbis. Not just, although this issue was often raised, on the issue of evacuating settlements, but also on following the IDF's ethical code on restraint in the use of force toward civilians. For instance, the then chief rabbi of the Israel Defense Forces, Avichai Ronsky, who was appointed to be chief rabbi because he had opposed disobeying orders during the Gaza withdrawal, but during Operation Cat Sled, he issued a booklet to soldiers, which among other things said that the Torah forbade cruelty, or he said, cruelty is a bad quality, but it all depends when. And then the booklet recommended using long-distance methods of fighting because it would protect Israeli soldiers and basically the civilian casualties didn't count. Now, this stood in total contradiction of the IDF's own ethical code, and it bothered me on two levels. It bothered me on the level of who's in charge here, and it bothered me on the level of a religious Jew because I felt very concerned about what was being presented in the name of Judaism. And it also made me wonder whether the real model that we should be concerned about not going down the same path as was Pakistan, where a coalition between secular politicians and religious extremists had led to a growing role of religious extremists in the country and in the military in particular. Now, in expressing those concerns, I want to go back a step in my own career and historically. Once, when I was working as the op-ed editor at the Jerusalem Report, I had a columnist who included, kindly call it a factual error in one of his columns. And I said, that's wrong, you can't say that. And he said, but this is an opinion article, that's my opinion. And I said, no, that's not how it works, let me explain. You can interpret the facts as you want, but you have to have the facts. You can say that it's wonderful that the state of Israel was established on May 14th, 1948, and you can say it was terrible, but you can't say that the state of Israel was established in 1953, okay? And then I realized afterwards that I'd given a really unsuitable example in trying to prove this case, because I myself, perhaps this comes from having studied too much Talmud, but I myself could make a case for all sorts of dates for when the state of Israel was established. For instance, I would strongly argue, and I do argue in this book, that the state of Israel was really established on June 21st to June 23rd, 1948, during the Altalena affair. That is when David Ben-Gurion ordered the newborn Israel Defense Forces to use force to prevent the Irgun underground from bringing in arms, which would allow it to remain essentially an independent fighting force. And by doing so, Ben-Gurion established the principle that the government had a monopoly on the legitimate use of force, and that there could be a democracy, because in a democracy, groups negotiate rather than fight in the street, and they negotiate on the basis of their electoral strength, not on the basis of how many guns they have. So you could say that that's when the state of Israel was established. You could say that the state of Israel was, in a sense, established in early 1949 as it signed armistice agreements, which at least de facto set what the territory of the state was, because basic to the definition of a modern state is that it rules a specific defined territory. And as a democracy, the state of Israel might have been born on January 25th, 1949, when the first elections were held. Although it's arguable that it was actually born as a democracy in October 1953, when I said you couldn't say the state of Israel was born, because that's when the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the Kol Ha'am case, where Justice Shlomo Agronat, probably the American Jew who has given most to Israel, gave Israel the right of the free press in a absolutely audacious act of judicial activism essentially said, Israel defines itself as democracy, and in democracy you have a free press. Therefore, Mr. Ben-Gurion, you cannot close a Communist Party newspaper because you didn't like their editorial. So I mention these things because Israel's creation and continued existence as a democracy are remarkable things. They are certainly unusual things in post-colonial history. You can't find another country established in the baby boom of countries after World War II that has remained a parliamentary democracy continuously to this day. And I don't want to see this lost. I don't want to be in a situation where, as I think is the case today, where leaders fear that they could not possibly evacuate settlements because soldiers might refuse orders or mutiny, not just on the level of low-ranking soldiers, but of officers. That seems to me an erasing and undoing of the lesson of the Alta Lena. Another way in which the state has been unraveled is that since 1967, the borders of the state have been removed from the map of the state. Israeli school children literally do not know where their state begins and ends. A study done in 2007 at Hebrew University and Bar-Ilan University found that at Hebrew U only one-third and at Bar-Ilan only one-quarter of the students could draw the green line, the pre-67 borders of Israel on the map. So they literally don't know where their country starts and ends. The rule of law, which is basic to democracy, is being undermined. A strong example of this is the Sison Report of 2005, documenting how government agencies funded the building of settlements which were illegal under Israeli law. And we currently face in the Knesset a wave of legislation aimed at using the Knesset majority to erase basic democratic rights, and particularly the rights of the Arab minority. Israel is my country. I've lived there for 34 years. I have two children serving in the Israel Defense Forces. I'm very proud of my 20-year-old daughter who signed extra time to become an officer. I am amazed and terrified at the amount of responsibility she has. I certainly never had that kind of responsibility at the age of 20 and probably never have since then. And I hope that by bringing information, I can contribute to changing the direction. And I also felt a responsibility in the book, a necessity, to propose part of that new direction. So in many ways, I think that the last chapter is most important. The standing on one foot version of the last chapter is three basic proposals. I think that in order to reestablish Israel, we need to separate synagogue and state. This is a divorce made in heaven. I think that we have to graduate from being a national liberation movement for a particular ethnic group to being a state responsible for all of its citizens. And I think that we have to end the occupation of the West Bank. I want to reverse the normal way of speaking about this. It isn't that we're making the painful sacrifice of territory in order to get to peace, but that we need peace in order to make the essential move of leaving the West Bank. So this book is meant as a warning, and it's meant as a expression of hope that we can rebuild Israel to be what it should be.
Just a reminder that if you have an index card with a question, please raise your hand and it will be collected and brought forward. Gershom, just picking up with where you ended, just to reiterate for a moment, the three prescriptions, right? Ending the occupation,
separating
church
state
and synagogue.
State and religion, yes. Synagogue and state, yeah.
And what you call in the book, becoming a liberal state rather than an ethnic movement. Or making the transition, you say at one point, from being a revolution to being an institution. And the question I want to ask you as a kind of observer of Israel is, how plausible or likely is it that any one of those things could happen in the next 10 years, let alone all three?
First of all, there's an interrelationship between them. For instance, I don't think, I'm going to be really careful about this. The Talmud says that when the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken from the prophets and given to children and fools. And the color of my beard makes it impossible for me to claim one of those statuses, and I certainly don't want to be put in the other one. I would have told you until this summer that as utterly upsetting as the economic change in Israel from a social democracy to a extreme neoliberal economy, as upsetting as that was, that there was no chance of a real movement beginning for economic change until the end of the occupation, because the occupation so totally dominates Israeli politics that until we settled the issue of the territories, we would never get to that. And then I found myself at the beginning of September being covering a set of marches in which somewhere between 6 and 7% of the Israeli population, that is to say, something equivalent to 18 to 20 million Americans, were marching on the street on the same night demanding a welfare state, taxing the rich, and social justice. So I was a bad prophet. And you want me to engage in prophecy about all these things. I can tell you that I arrived in Israel originally as a student to spend a year studying Torah. It's been a long year. September of 1977, and if anybody in Israel had predicted in September of 1977 that in November of 1977, the leader of the country that had launched a surprise attack against us 4 years earlier would come to Jerusalem and proclaim his desire for peace in front of the Knesset, and that Menachem Begin would agree to give up the Sinai Peninsula in return for that peace agreement, that person would have been a candidate for psychiatric hospitalization. That was only one of the several amazing things that happened in my first 2 months in Israel, some good and some bad. So if you ask me, can this happen, I will tell you that the only thing that you can be certain of in the Middle East and in Israel is what you don't expect will happen. I'm not going to try to take that further and say the more you don't expect it, the more likely it is to happen, although it sometimes, sort of on a gut level feels that way. I would assume that it would be easier to separate synagogue and state after a peace agreement, because it would be easier to address other issues when coalitions are not built on the basis of who supports the continued occupation and who doesn't. But I could be wrong about that.
Well, let's stay for a minute with this question of Israeli leaders and what they will and won't do. And one thing that is sort of manifestly clear in this book is just how little you think of Israel's current prime minister. And yet...
That's a total exaggeration. And, I do not think that highly of him.
And yet... one thing that struck me in reading your book is that you don't talk in broad terms about the lack of moral and political leadership in Israel. Is there a meaningful and plausible alternative to Bibi on any conceivable horizon in your mind? Or more dramatically, will the next generation have alternatives that are different from, better than, Bibi and Barak?
You know, you're reminding me that when my son was reading the Harry Potter books, and the name of the newspaper was the Daily Prophet, he said, "You know, Abba, that's really true. People claim they're reading the newspaper to find out what happened, but what they really want you to do is tell them what's going to happen." I would say, for instance, that the wave of social protest this summer has already shaken Israeli politics, and we don't know what leaders are going to emerge out of that. The current leaders of Israel are bankrupt several times over as leaders. Netanyahu, this is really an achievement that I think we should pay attention to. Netanyahu feels that he has to say that he's in favor of a two-state solution, even though he's doing everything he can to prevent it. This is proof of the adage that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. However, it also means that a two-state solution has become defined as a mainstream position and virtue. In the beginning of the 1980s, when I was one of the founders of Netivot Shalom, the religious peace movement that unfortunately didn't have as much influence as I hoped at the time, but okay. And I was the one person that was not interviewed for an article that was written about it for an American magazine because I was dating the reporter at the time, who's now my wife and the mother of my children. But in any case, she interviewed one of the founders, and she said, "What's your solution to the conflict?" And he says, "I have to go off the record here. I'm in favor of a two-state solution of a Palestinian state, but you can't report me as saying that because it will delegitimize the movement." In other words, in the early 80s, to be in favor of a Palestinian state was such a radical position that somebody who was in favor of territorial concessions for peace would not go on the record as saying that they wanted a Palestinian state. And that's a mainstream position now, so much so that Bibi pays tribute to it, even though it would be difficult to imagine less sincerity. Barack is somebody who has spent the last 11 years justifying his own failure in the peace process by insisting that the other side is unwilling to make peace. And both of them are willing to sit in a coalition with Avigdor Lieberman, who is Israel's version of the far-right the leaders of far-right parties in places like Austria, Italy, and elsewhere in Europe, in his way of thinking. This is a poisonous combination. I think that politics is a very surprising thing. And I'm not going to... And the other thing is, the fact that I can't name for you who's going to be prime minister next is not a reason to give up hope. I would put it differently. Giving up hope is a luxury that is only available to people who are far enough away from the situation that the refusal to change things or the inability to change things doesn't affect them directly. Those of us who are in the middle of it, I feel like there's an isur d'oraita to give up hope. It's you know, it's a basic commandment not to give up hope, but rather to try to create changes.
So, Yair Shelag said something to me this past winter that I, in light of what you said, I wonder if you'd be willing to comment on, which is that there's an amazing paradox at the heart of Israeli society and politics right now, which is that on the one hand, everyone now accepts what was the Meretz party platform for 20 years, and everyone reviles Meretz. How do you understand that?
It's a really good point. Some aspects of that are sociological, which is that Meretz, besides being a party that was that stood for, I don't know what they stand for today, to be honest, but they're also part of the bankruptcy of Israeli politics at this moment. They stood for a secular agenda and for a peace process, but they also represented a very narrow Ashkenazi urban sector of the Israeli public. And it was sort of like, you know, you were the party of the Upper West Side and you were running for elections in Alabama and you were going to be unpopular no matter what you know, whatever you said. Even if you said what everybody wanted to hear in Alabama, you'd be unpopular because you, right? So that's part of it. And part of it is I think that psychologically people don't like to admit their mistakes. It's not good for popularity to be too far out in front. I will say to you that there's, you know, there's Americans who opposed the war in Iraq in the beginning of 2003 and were considered traitors and other politicians didn't want to be around them because they were radioactive. And, you know, a couple of years later, or 5 years later, anybody who had held that position was desperately trying to explain it away, at least in one party's primary. So being out in front on issues like this is I think that's a general human thing. It's not a way... And if you say, "I told you so," then you're going to make yourself even more unpopular. Just remember what your mother is saying that to you, and you'll understand.
Question from the crowd here, which gives you an opportunity to talk about something you do talk about in the book, which is to express your arguments against a one-state solution.
Well, first of all, I don't think that those two terms go together, one state and solution. One state is in some ways the current nightmare, not the solution. That is to say, there is one state which effectively exercises control over almost all the territory between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, and that's what's wrong. because inside of that territory there's a large population that is disenfranchised. Within parts of that territory, there are some people who have the vote and some people who don't, some people who live under Israeli law and some people who live under military law. That's the negative situation. When people talk about one state being a solution, though, what they mean is, okay, we'll give everybody the vote. Now, I would say as an aside, part of the reason that that comes up particularly, I think, in the context of American discussion, and now even more specific campus discussion and so forth, is that progressives can also be terribly regressive. They can also want to fight the last battle, particularly if they were born a little bit too late for it. If they were in it and they won it, then they want to fight it again. And if they were got there too late, they want to fight it again. So people sit, talk about Israel being an apartheid state, and they talk about it, one person, one vote, and it's all like, we're just going to run this play over again. And if we missed it, we'll be successful again. And my feeling about that is Tolstoyan, which is that every unhappy country is unhappy in a different way. And we're not South Africa, and it's not apartheid. It's not good, but it's a different kind of not good. And that one person, one vote in the context of what would become the Eastern Mediterranean Republic would create a situation where, first of all, the next parliament elected would be 50% Palestinian and 50% Jewish. It would still have to deal with the issue of the settlements, because the settlements are overwhelmingly located on land which was not only occupied land, but was owned by Palestinians and was taken from them in various ways. No judiciary or legislative branch could avoid that problem. It would still have to deal with the issue of Palestinian refugees from 1948 and whether they could reclaim their property. In fact, it would still have to deal with the issue of who controlled which holy places. Everything on the agenda except for borders, which is the easiest issue on the agenda of peace negotiations, would still be there. But instead of being an issue for negotiations, it would be an issue for a deadlocked parliament. And in a utopian vision, we'd only be as bad off as Belgium, where it's impossible to form a government. And in a more likely vision, we would be something like Bosnia or Lebanon. It would not solve the conflict. It would bring the, it would totally internalize the conflict in a dysfunctional state. Both Jews and Palestinians want self-determination, and the way of achieving that is the same way that was on the table in 1947, which is partition. And I would note in that context that a week or two ago on Channel 2 in Israel, in a rare interview to Channel 2, Mahmoud Abbas said, "We Arabs made a mistake in not accepting the partition in 1947," which is a pretty daring statement for a Palestinian leader to make. We blew it, we should have accepted it, but we want partition now. And I think that we've spent the last 63 years saying they made a mistake by not accepting it. I don't want us to make the same mistake.
So let's talk about this two-state solution for a minute, and in light of your comments, your reporting of Abbas's comment. In his recent book, One State, Two States, Benny Morris argues that no Palestinian leader has ever given up on eventually obliterating Israel completely. None, he insists, have reconciled themselves to the two-state solution, and he, to use one of his favorite words, considers it mendacious to suggest otherwise. Perhaps tellingly, he would probably quote other recent statements of Abbas, namely that it's time to end 63 years of Israeli occupation. Not 44 years, mind you, but 63. So I guess I would ask you a two-pronged question about this. First of all, is Morris's portrayal accurate? And second of all, if it is, what implications should that have for how Israel should go forward?
So I'll start with a story. In 2007, while working on a long article, which was originally for The Atlantic, I was sitting in Ramallah with a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council who had formerly been a commander of the Al-Aqsa Brigade in Nablus, a man whose face was a map drawn in battle wounds and scars. And Speaking in his hoarse whisper, he said, "Our program is a two-state solution," as he banged on the table. But the thing is that as a member of Fatah, he's not just saying that to the Israeli audience. That is, Mahmoud Abbas has based his political career on the idea that the two-state solution is the necessary outcome of the conflict. Now, does that mean that he's singing Hatikva? Does that mean that he doesn't think that Jaffa and Haifa are part of Palestine? No, it doesn't. But you want to know something? You know, I also know that Hebron is part of Eretz Israel. I mean, maybe this is terribly upsetting. Maybe I've just lost my progressive credentials. I know that Hebron is part of Eretz Israel, and that there's Jewish history all over the West Bank. And I also know that in the real world, sometimes you have to settle for less than dreams and visions, and in order to get to other things that are important to you. And I think that my experience reporting is that Morris is wrong. And I also think that this is a case where, Benny is a really rigorous historian. And part of his rigor as a historian, sometimes I think he goes too far with this, is an insistence on documents and not interviewing. But this isn't history, this is right now. And to find out what Palestinians think, part of what you need to do is to talk to Palestinians.
Maybe a historical question from the same lens. Had Israel, since you are one of the important historians of the settlement movement, had Israel withdrawn from the conquered territories, and the territories it conquered in 67, shortly thereafter, is there a sort of counter-historical narrative where it would thereby now be negotiating over Tel Aviv and Haifa? When you remember historically that the PLO was founded before this occupation, right? The PLO was born, I guess, formally in 1964, to end something other than the occupation of the West Bank. So how do you imagine that scenario that you've written about would have unfolded differently had the sort of then very lonely left been heeded?
Well, we keep talking at cross purposes here, because the other thing that every historian is taught is not to write the what-if scenario, because you don't know what all the other factors would have been in that scenario.
I'm forcing you to.
I don't know what would have happened then. What I can tell you is that in September of 1968, there was a meeting in London, which on one side was the young King Hussein and his prime minister, and on the other side was Abi Ibn and Yigal Alon. I don't have my notes in front of me, but my memory is that it was held in the clinic of a Jewish doctor who was friends with Hussein. And Alon presented his famous Alon plan, which called for Israel to give up the populated mountain area of the West Bank north of Jerusalem and to keep the rest. And he was in his own description, this was the great moment of his life that he had the opportunity to present this plan to Hussein, and he was sure that Hussein would see the wisdom of it. And Hussein said, "This is wholly unacceptable." And Alon said, "You have to understand that there's a war and you lost it." And Hussein said, "Yes, we understand that. And that is why we're now willing to accept what we were not willing to accept before the war, which is Israel's existence within the pre-war lines." Now, in fact, the Arab positions taken after the 67 war reflected exactly that position. Can I tell you what their position would have been if something had been negotiated then? No, I can't tell you. I can tell you that this was the argument made against peace with Egypt, and that we negotiated peace with Egypt, and that no other single act, as far as I can see, has done as much to contribute to Israel both in security and in economic terms as signing peace with Egypt. And so I would say that, yeah, the Palestinians were in a different place in 1964 than they were in 1968, than they were in 1988, than they are now. And we were in a different place. We're talking here about history and people, not geology. It's not an accident, by the way, that one of the most rigid people in Israeli politics, Benny Begin, is a geologist. He just doesn't quite get that he's dealing with people and not with rocks. Even though I have a lot of respect for his personal integrity, which is not something that I can say of many of his colleagues.
You know that old Israeli song, Yesh Anashim Im Lev Shel Evan, right? a question from the crowd is, Amazon.com states that you argue that Israel must create a new civic identity, that can be shared by Jews and Arabs in order to save itself. What does that actually mean?
What it means is that, okay, I'm going to try to step back here and give a counterexample. There are countries in which, the best example of this is one version of French civil identity, in which the individual is not supposed to have a group identity between him or herself and the state. It's threatening to the common shared civic identity that you would be a Frenchman and also something else. And there are other countries where that's an accepted reality, that people have multiple identities. I think that it is possible. I think that I saw this going on during the social protests this summer, for people to share a sense that they live in a country and that they have a common concern with the quality of life in that country, and with the safety of living in that country, and with the future of their children in that country, and with social equality in that country, and also have a collective identity as Jews, Palestinians, or something else. And I think that it is possible for a country to have an ethnic majority and to respect the rights of an ethnic minority, and for both groups to have a shared sense of citizenship, of, you know. And these are things that are on a really practical level. We both want the streets to be clean, and we both want there to be the freedom to say what we believe in, and we both want to be able to tell our history. And we live in this country together. And we can also have identities that we don't share. Does this mean that being Jewish and being Israeli are not synonymous? Yeah, I think that that's true. In fact, I think that I'll go further with this, and this, I guess, is the guy wearing the kippah saying this. I think that Israel, in some ways, lets Jews off too easy, because I think that it's a shame that there are as many Israelis as there are who think that by living in Israel and serving in the army and speaking Hebrew, they've solved the question for themselves of what it means to be Jewish. And precisely by having Israeli being as a roof identity, they would be confronted with some interesting existential questions about whether they're Jewish and what it means to be Jewish. It would be healthy confusion.
Well, let's shift gears for a minute. And I'll ask you a question that maybe is a little unexpected and off kilter. You talk a lot in the book about how Israeli society as a whole, and Israeli leadership in particular, has failed to make the political and psychological shift necessary to move from, again to use that phrase, from revolution to institution, or from national movement to statehood. How much of that is a function of what we might call collective PTSD? That is, the aftershocks of the Shoah, war after bloody war, constant fear induced by terrorism. What do you think can be done to heal some of that? How does one deal with a society that is fundamentally traumatized and therefore, I won't even fill in the therefore. You can fill in the therefore.
I feel like I'm at the end of Portnoy's complaint, where the psychologist finally breaks in and says, now we can begin. after that immense monologue. I don't know how you put an entire country, or for that matter, an entire people on the couch. I grew up...
like an urgent imperative.
Yeah, look,
right?
I'll tell you. You know, I grew up with that syndrome. When I was 12 years old, I was at my grandmother's house, and under the glass of the, in fact, my first published poem, the first thing I ever published was written about this experience. Under the glass on the coffee table, there was a photograph, an old photograph, and it showed six men and a couple of children, and there was a 12-year-old girl and a middle-aged woman with a tichel with a headscarf on and an old woman with a scarf. And I said, who are these people? And my grandmother pointed to the 12-year-old girl, and she said, that's me. And I said, so who are all these men? And she says, those are my brothers. And I said, so those are my great-uncles. Where are they? And then she told me that they had all been killed on the same day. 1919. I actually only got the date later. It was actually a more complicated that four of them and four of the brothers and two of the brothers' sons were killed on that day, but I got a little bit confused about it the first time I heard the story. And it also turned out that that was my grandparents' wedding day, because they had been warned of the pogrom at 5:30 in the morning by a Gentile, and they were engaged, and they got married and left the village, and the pogrom started later that morning, and they fled to America. And that was the trauma with which my father was brought up as an only child, and he did his best to pass it on to me, and I guess it's... and so what I would say is that the first... Okay, let me add another story to this. This Saturday night, I went to cover the latest march of the social protest movement in Jerusalem. And the march, the previous marches had begun next to the Mashbir in downtown Jerusalem and marched down to the Prime Minister's house. And for some reason or another, I don't know whether it was the organizer's idea or the police's idea, this time we marched to the Knesset. And that involved marching up the hill from central Jerusalem and into Nachlaot. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the geography. We started marching into Nachlaot down Bezalel Street. And all of a sudden, a shudder of adrenaline and fear ran through my body. And it took me a couple of minutes to understand what had just happened, which was that in 1983... In February of 1983, after the Kahn Commission report was published about the Sabra and Shatila massacre, and Peace Now organized a march to the Knesset to demand the resignation of Ariel Sharon, we had marched up that street. And the crowd had hurled things at us, including the crowd along the sides had hurled things at us, including burning cigarettes, and jumped out and punched us. And at the end of that march, a grenade was hurled into the crowd, and Emil Grunzweig was killed. So marching into that crowd, marching into that street, without any conscious sense of it, I was suddenly 28 years before. But there's another part of that story. There was no hostile crowd along the roads. The balconies where the people had been throwing at us things from the balconies at us were empty. And the image wasn't true. And... the image, okay, to quote, one of my favorite, least favorite quotes is Bibi Netanyahu saying to an American Jewish crowd in Los Angeles 5 years ago, "This is 1938 and Iran is Germany." That is a profoundly anti-Zionist statement. Because in 1938, the Jews did not have submarines somewhere out there carrying nuclear-tipped missiles with second strike capability, according to foreign reports. to treat our situation as if we are a shtetl surrounded by Islamic Cossacks is not to accept the success of the Zionist movement in creating a strong and successful Jewish state. Abba Ibn once said, "The Jews don't know how to take yes for an answer." History has given us a different condition than my grandparents lived under. And we should try to accept that our condition has changed.
Shifting gears again from the crowd, what do you think would be the Sadat visit of the day that would shock the parties into a peace agreement?
Gee, I don't know. I should have said to you, you know, Mahmoud Abbas saying on Israeli TV that we were mistaken not to accept partition 63 years ago, but it clearly hasn't had that effect. Bashar Assad is a little bit busy this week, so he's not coming to Jerusalem. And in some ways, I think that the problem is the opposite, which is that we need an Israeli leader who's willing to go to Ramallah and say we're willing to make a two-state solution.
I want to pick up on a theme in your book that's kind of a different angle, one that was very resonant with me. It's manifest on almost every page of this book how distressing you find most of contemporary religious Zionism. Here's just some selections. You speak at one point of yeshivot which, quote, barbarize Judaism, of students who desecrate Judaism. You talk about Avichai Ronsky, former chief rabbi of the IDF, as defiling Judaism with his racist halachic psak. On the other hand, you regard contemporary Israeli Haredi culture as fundamentally corrupt and parasitic, as a perverse Jewish innovation masquerading as fidelity to the past. So, I want to ask you a little bit of a personal question. Does all this ever make you want to throw it all away, along the lines of, if this is Judaism, count me out? And if not, what keeps you so passionately in?
Well, there are mornings that I wake up and I say, this isn't my religion. I'll give you a more, a more tactile example of that. When I was working on the book, there was several days I spent out doing research at outposts in the area of Nablus. And in the evening, I went to interview a couple in Yitzhar who were sort of described to me as being the mom and dad of the hilltop youth, of the young radicals of the outposts. And before I come, I had asked them if there was a place that I could rent a room in Yitzhar for the night, because I really didn't feel like driving home from Yitzhar at night. It's not a good place to drive home from at night. So they said, no, you can stay in our house. Okay. So I said, all right, that's one more reporting experience. So I went and I interviewed them. It was like a 3-4 hour interview. They described to me going down. There was an attempted terrorist who infiltrated into one of the nearby settlements one Shabbat and injured a boy in this outpost. And in response, on Shabbat, the entire settlement had gone down to the neighboring Palestinian village and thrown what I can only describe as a pogrom. And they were pleased with this, and they said that they had done the right thing. And it was an intense interview. And then, before I went to sleep, I suddenly realized I'm in a religious settlement. I'll find out where the shul is. I can make shachrit in the morning. And the shul was down the street. And I got up in the morning and I said, if I go to this shul for shachrit, the words are going to be all the words that I know so well that I have to remember to pay attention while I'm saying them. And they're not going to mean any of the things that I mean by them. And even though I recognize the mitzvah of tefillah b'tzibur, of davening in a community, this isn't my religious community. It's in some strange way, it's like this alternative universe. People are saying the same words, but it's not my religion. My Judaism, I guess the earliest experience I have of like sort of consciously figuring out where my Judaism was reading Avraham Yehoshua Heschel. And perhaps that's shaped my direction religiously ever since then. And Heschel's concept that righteousness is what God wants of human beings is God's stake in history, as he writes. And Ronsky's idea that you should not withhold your sword from blood exist in separate universes. You know what? I'm not going to give them the pleasure of ceasing to be religious because of that distorted interpretation of Judaism. I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up that argument. I do remember the experience of reading Sholem's book on Shabtai Tzvi, in which he describes Yaakov Sasportis, the one sane man left in the Jewish world during the Shabbatian outbreak of 1665, desperately writing to people that this guy was not Mashiach. I cannot compare myself to Yaakov Sasportis. Unfortunately, there's more than one sane person. There's a lot of people who disagree with this. But all right, so you have to be willing to be in the minority sometimes.
So, in light of that, I'm going to force you into the prophetic mode again.
You just don't give up.
The people who... yes, that's not a bad description of this institution, too. What are the people who you feel ideological affinity with? What are the prospects for a politically meaningful and or numerically significant religious Zionist left reemerging in Israel? What would have to happen?
I'm not going to predict the unexpected. I'm going to go back and tell you a story from the past, which is part of how we got into this situation. And it makes me think of what might be necessary to change the situation, but I don't know what's necessary to change the situation, outside of everybody who cares about it doing as much as they can and trying to reach out to as many people as they can and making their voice heard and all that. But until 1967, Svi Yehuda Cook, the head of Mirkaza Rav, Avram Yitzhak Cohen Cook's son, who's with his radical vision that the state of Israel was a sign that the Messiah was coming, and his mourning over the fact that partition had been accepted in 1947, was a marginal figure in Israeli Judaism. And the ecstasy after 1967 and people's need to give meaning to that ecstasy is what propelled Svi Yehuda Cook and his followers from the margins into the center. And there were two things going on here. There was somebody who had an idea beforehand. It's not like the theology was created by the event, but there were also historical changes that made people capable of hearing him, to my sorrow, but that's what happened. So a change, I would expect, and this is making the mistake of learning from experience, which is often been a bad teacher, as I said before. But I would expect that the religious change will be a result of both the fact that people are presenting other ideas and that changes in circumstances will force more people to reconsider their ideas. I will also say that there's something a little bit dialectical here, which is the more extreme the religious right becomes, the more it pushes people who are moderate to make choices that they wouldn't have made before. Now I'll tell the little bit I know about Yehuda Amital's history. Rabbi Yehuda Amital was the head of the first Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, and he was chosen for that job by Hanan Porat, the founder of the reborn Kibbutz Kfar Etzion. And he was chosen for it because he was completely in line with the ideology of Messianic Zionism that Porat believed in. And in his early years as Rosh Yeshiva at Har Tzion, he was a completely convinced proponent that the State of Israel and the 1967 war were signs of the approaching Geula. Redemption. In 1982, he broke publicly with that camp, and even though he was still insisting that we're in a process of redemption, came out in favor of giving up territory for peace. In 1973, right after the Yom Kippur War, he wrote an essay about the Yom Kippur War in which he dealt with the dissonance between that war and its losses and the idea that we were on our way to redemption. And he essentially described the war as the Battle of Gog and Magog, and it was the last effort of the nations to prevent redemption. Total theodicy of the war in terms of Cookian theology. Years later, I interviewed Yehuda Etzion, who was one of the well-known and extreme leaders of the far religious right, and who was studying at Har Etzion at the time, and he said, oh, I could already tell then that the war broke Amital's connection. In other words, in his view, having talked to his teacher at that time, that essay was the swan song of... That was Amital's last desperate bid to protect his previous faith that these victories were signs of redemption, and that what happened 9 years later, the seeds of it were already there then. So I don't know what seeds are out there now. All I can do is do my best to put other ideas forward and hope that other people will do that, and to hope that the circumstances will make it easier for people to hear that.
What role do American Jews have in all this, in addressing the crisis that you describe, and maybe even in helping push forward the solutions that you advocate? what should the posture of American Jews be in general, and what role should they play?
Well, part of that goes back to your PTSD question. During the second Lebanon War, I got a letter from a friend of mine, I mean a really old friend of mine. We went to high school together. We were roommates in college. He's a Reform rabbi somewhere out there. I won't say where in America now. And he was talking about the war. And I was, like, less worried about Israel's... You know, he was in, like, total panic mode. Like, Israel is about to fall because of this war in Lebanon. And I was saying that that was not the way to relate to what was going on in Israel. And at some point or another, he wrote me an email which basically said, if we're not going to relate to besieged Israel, how do we relate to Israel? And my first answer to that is, give up siege Zionism. Okay? Israel lives in a dangerous neighborhood. We need an army. I'm proud of my kids serving in the army. I wish to hell I knew what they were doing, but they're never going to tell me. And if my son ever starts slipping, my daughter will shut him up. She's the officer. Look. But in any case, give up siege Judaism. The problem of the state of Israel right now is not that we are about to be wiped off the map by the Arabs. Yes, there are serious dangers. We're always going to need a military. Mashiach is not around the corner. And all those things are true. But we're not in that existential moment there, and that's not what we need from American Jewry, to schrei Gewalt all the time. So I'm going to offer a different model of the relationship. What Israel offers to American Jews is the experience of self-determination, that is to say, a place where the public sphere is Jewish, where the argument about what it means to be Jewish is the public argument, the majority argument, and not the minority argument, where the holidays are Jewish, and even things as prosaic and quotidian as what the image of beauty is Jewish rather than somebody else's. Okay, the discos are playing, you know, have Jewish DJs, and the majority religion is Judaism, and I think that for many American Jews who come to Israel, that is an intense experience, being in that place. It's an inside-out experience in some ways, because, I mean, I know it was for me when I first arrived in Israel. Private has become public, right? And it's a liberating experience. What American Jews have to offer to Israel is a reminder to Israelis of what it means to be the minority and what you demand when you're the minority, and that you shouldn't give up those demands when you become the majority. As it were, American Jewry should be reminding Israel, we were strangers in Egypt, we were strangers in Russia, we were even strangers in the United States. When you're the minority, you want equal rights for the minority, you want civil rights, you want the state to stay out of religion. So American Jewry can support every possible institution and voice in Israel that is working to preserve what we learned out of the diaspora experience. And it can support, politically, a diplomatic solution, which is much more important to Israel's future than Schrei Gewalt.
Okay, well, let's push this a little further. Imagine for a second, I'm almost tempted to do a role play, but I feel like we'll both feel like we're six, but imagine for a second...
I'll grow up a little bit.
Imagine that you are sitting with an American Jewish college student who says to you something like the following. Look, I read your book. I agree with 97% of what you say. But here's the thing. I don't want to be in bed with the campus left. I don't want to be in bed with them. I don't trust them. I don't like the way they talk about Jews. I don't like the way they talk about Israel. Their obsession with Israel is disproportional to everything imaginable, right? If I lived in their universe, the Israeli occupation would be the single greatest moral crime of the 20th century, which is bankrupt on its face as a claim. Given that I don't want to be in bed with those people, what do I do? How do I find a home to say what you're saying without giving aid and comfort to people I have no interest in giving aid and comfort to?
If the home isn't there, build it. I mean, That's true in any political situation. I mean, if there's one of two possibilities. There's an organization of it. I'm not getting into the details of American Jewish organizations, and I'm not close enough to it to say which organization I would endorse. And besides which, as a journalist, I'm not going to start endorsing organizations, because whichever organization becomes powerful next, I'm going to do what a journalist does and write about what they did wrong. In fact, if I met the college kid who told me he agreed with 97% of what I wrote, I would have to argue with him and convince him to agree with less than that. But there's one of two possibilities. Either the organization is out there that presents a more moderate and complex view of things that can be... Either the organization is out there on your campus that can present an alternative to Israel is all right and Israel is all wrong, or organize. I mean, obviously, get together people, stick up a sign, put something on Facebook, get together other people who agree with you, and present an alternative. What's the big chokhmah here?
Spinning a question from the crowd a little bit. Talk about, if you would, your views of Seiruv, of refusal of military orders. In a democratic society, when is it acceptable and when is it not? How should the society respond, and the government, for that matter?
Okay, I'm going to be very careful with this for a couple of reasons. And the first reason is that because of health conditions which would have kept me out of anybody else's army completely, I was never a combat soldier, and I was never confronted with this question up close. And I don't want to have the... Yohara, the hubris to put myself in the position of people who have had to confront that question on a much more immediate and visceral level. There's a section of my book in which I talk about this on a philosophical level at greater length and more coherently than I'm going to manage to do here. Just because it took me a really long time to write that section. So it was hard work. On one level, a democracy cannot function if every soldier decides for him or herself when to follow the orders. And unfortunately, we live in a world where not only does a country like Israel need an army, but I even think that it's a moral obligation to have an army. And I will let me make a side point about that. I realized when I was working on a long article about nonviolence several years ago, and I was reading actually an Islamic interpretation of the Cain and Abel story, in which Abel speaks and says, "I won't kill you. I'd rather die than kill you, than take the sin of killing you." That is not the extreme moral situation. Because Abel's got it easy in that story. He can preserve his honor, or his self-respect, or his sense of meaning, by dying. It's his life. The extreme situation is if you said, "I won't kill in order to save somebody else." And in Judaism, that's an immoral position. And when you live in a collective that's threatened, and other people could die because you're not willing to participate in the military, I don't think that absolute nonviolence is an acceptable moral stance. Once you have a military, it should be controlled by the civilian government and not by every individual deciding for him or herself. With that said, I will state a qualification and a qualification of the qualification. I'm sorry, this is a really Talmudic discussion. The qualification is there are obviously points, and this is even recognized in Israeli law, where there are orders that should not be followed. Okay? Where there is a moral stance which is more important than the law, than the law to obey orders. If your commander tells you to kill civilians, it is not, even in an Israeli military court, an acceptable defense that you were following orders. Thank God. We did learn something from our history. You can't do that. You can't say, "I was following orders." So the question is, well, the law and the order isn't your moral stance. Does that enter us into a range of utter relativism where everybody decides for himself when an order can be disobeyed? And one person says, I didn't disobey this order because it was illegal because I was ordered to murder civilians. And another person says, I didn't obey this order because it was immoral because they told me to evacuate a Jewish settlement in Eretz Israel. And I would say, no, I'm not a relativist. The first situation is a moral situation, and the second situation is a political situation. In the second situation, you are trying to impose your political views on the government and bring politics into an institution which should not be politicized, and calling it an ultimate moral statement. I think many of the people who say that really believe it's an ultimate moral statement, but I think that that's an example of very, very bad religious education. And in the first situation, you are confronted with a conflict between the laws of the state and an absolute moral imperative. I don't think that those situations are that common. I wouldn't want a situation where soldiers were constantly saying, I have to disobey this order. So I come back to my starting point. Can I tell you which situations or which? No, I haven't been there.
What about the kid who calls you up and says, you know, Gershom, I just read your book, and the very act of serving in the West Bank is to me a violation of what I understand to be the core of Judaism's moral message. What should I do?
I would say in that situation that... you can violate a specific order because you're being told to do something that at that moment is immoral. But when you're saying, I'm not going to serve, I think that you are politicizing the military. I say that with... I sort of shake when I say it because I'm not sure where the line is. And I will say again, having been asthmatic since the age of 7, having a military profile that would have kept me out of Nam but was not enough to keep me out of getting drafted in Israel, I was never put in that position. And I interviewed people who formed the Omitz Serev organization during the Second Intifada who said, you know, each individual order is acceptable in itself, but the sum total of them becomes something that a black flag is flying over. And I understand the argument, and it's a very difficult one to deal with. I think that if you take that too far, you end up in a situation where you have politicized the military, which is a very, very dangerous place to be.
Okay. Again, playing with some questions from the crowd. Why do you believe it's not too late for a two-state solution? Meaning, let's take a concrete example. It's extremely unlikely that any Palestinian leader would accept Ariel remaining where it is. And yet, it's hard to imagine any Israeli leader courageous enough to risk evacuating it. So what actually happens?
Well, you know, that's interesting because that was one of the sticking points in the Abu Ariel was the remaining sticking point in the border negotiations between Abu Mazen and Olmert. But I already said to you, I think that the border argument is the easiest one in there. Okay, Abu Mazen had gotten up to 1.9% of the West Bank remaining in Israeli hands, and Olmert had gotten down to 5.9% of the West Bank, 5.8% of the West Bank remaining in Israeli hands. And had Olmert not been under indictment for doing everything except for stealing candy from babies, and they'll get to that yet, they probably would have ended up at 3.9%. The border issue is really not the deal stopper. There are things that are more difficult. I sort of feel when I look at the periods when negotiations have been going on that I'm looking at Zeno's paradox in political terms. Each time they go half the distance left and still don't get there. I think that there have been political situations in the modern world where solutions were changes have happened that are much that are no less impressive than Israel pulling out of the West Bank, I A, I don't believe that changes are impossible. Among other reasons, because I've seen enough changes that were impossible happen. Growing up in the United States in the 60s and 70s, if you had told me that an African-American man could be elected president of the United States, I would have told you that, like, you obviously just got off the plane and you don't know this country. And if he was going to win the vote in California, which was West Oklahoma in terms of the way it voted in those days, remember, that's where Nixon and Reagan came from, you would have been even crazier. So politics is, I'm going to say this again, it's not geology. Major changes happen. Sometimes they happen in a very short period after them seeming to be stuck. Actually, the one way in which politics is like geology is it's like, you know, going back to my California experience, like the pressure builds up and builds up and builds up on this fault, and all of a sudden it moves like that. So I don't know, I can't predict for you what the details are of how this would take place. I know that all the alternatives are worse. And therefore, being at the bottom, somebody who thinks that pessimism is a luxury, and I don't have that luxury, I'm going to keep trying to push for people to take the reasonable, sane way out of the situation.
If anyone else would like a card, you can raise your hand.
So got a last go-around on cards for those who want to ask questions.
There was somebody back there.
We haven't talked much about, and I want to give you a chance to talk about, since this is one of the chapters of your book, the role of Haredim in contemporary Israeli politics, and more broadly, the cultural question of how Haredi culture can, must, should evolve in the coming decades.
Well, for one thing, Haredi culture is evolving while we're sitting here and talking. I had this experience while I was working on the book. I went and interviewed this Haredi guy who's 40 and expected to have a job teaching Torah or being a city rabbi or something like that by this point in his life, and there are no such jobs, so he doesn't have one, and so he's a kolelnik. And first he said, I'm not a typical Haredi. The reason that you know I'm not a typical Haredi is because I'm willing to be interviewed by you. At the end of the interview, he got called into the other room by his wife, who, after that conversation with his wife, he came back and made me sign a statement that I would not reveal his name or where he lived, because if anybody figured out who he was, it would harm their children's chances of a shidduch. And yet, the other thing I remember about the evening is that his son was going out for his private English lesson, which has become a new fad in Haredi neighborhoods. So what's the story? You can't go to college or get a good job in Israel without knowing English. And especially in Jerusalem, Haredi schools don't teach English. So there's a flourishing industry that's popped up in the last 5 years of private English lessons, which is a sign that people know that something's got to change, that the pendulum has gone too far in one direction. The basic sort of sense that I have here is that the Haredi community itself has reached economically a point of crisis. It is unsustainable. I'll tell you, a story that's in the book, which is that this was a really amazing experience for me, because the building where this took place was a few hundred meters from the Jerusalem Post building where I once worked. There's this big Haredi housing development. It was like 5 or 7, I don't remember which, apartment buildings and a courtyard in the middle that has more small children in it playing in the afternoon than you could imagine could fit into that space. And they're nice apartments. A lot of them have illegal balconies built on them or whatever for new bedrooms, but they're nice apartments, and that's where Haredim who do have jobs or who got an education abroad before making Aliyah or who were city rabbis or whatever, people who actually have money are living. And under the building there's a 3-story parking garage. And in the parking garage, as with many Israeli buildings, there are storerooms, because very often when you buy an apartment you get a storeroom downstairs. And the storeroom is where you put your sukkah and your old clothes and the baby carriage for the 3 weeks a year that you're not using it. And all that sort of stuff. Except that on some of those storerooms, there are names on the door and a water meter attached outside and a and a doorbell, because these apartments, these rooms, which I paced off as being 8 paces by 8 paces, have been rented out to young families as apartments. And they open, their windows and doors are into the gloom of the parking garage. And that's the underbelly. That's the suppressed subconscious of the Haredi universe today, is children, is families who cannot provide apartments for their children, and they're living in places like that. And that's a crisis. And that crisis is pushing change.
Okay, I'm going to just read some direct questions from the crowd, and I'll read a couple, and you can handle them together. What leads you to believe that the result of withdrawing from the West Bank will be any different than the result of withdrawing from Gaza and from Lebanon, given the ongoing denial of Palestinian leaders, media, and education system of any legitimate Jewish connection to the land? That's one. Two, you have not mentioned Hamas at all. How does Gaza Hamas fit into a peace plan, given the ongoing violence coming from there? And then, just to add icing to this, how do you explain the fact that giving up land for peace has not worked in either Gaza or Lebanon? Sorry to give you all three of those, but I...
Well, they're all the same question, so it's okay. When people say giving up land for peace hasn't worked, they're ignoring the most significant example, which is that we gave up Sinai, and the single largest and most powerful army opposing us was taken out of the game, and that the Israeli defense budget went from 33% of the GDP to somewhere around 6%, and that the military risks to Israel were drastically reduced, and despite all of the political changes that have happened since then, and despite our very explicitly not keeping to basic tenets of that agreement at the beginning, such as setting up Palestinian autonomy in the first 5 years after the agreement, because of the dynamics of the Middle East, and because we are a very strong country, and war was more costly to Egypt than it was to us, that agreement has lasted since 1979, and if we don't mess things up too badly, we can allow it to continue to last. We pulled out of Lebanon and Gaza without agreements. And the reason that we did that is that the leaders of Israel at the time, Ehud Barak in 2000 when we left Lebanon, and Ariel Sharon in 2005 when we left Gaza, were not willing to make the peace agreements that would have allowed us to pull out as part of an agreement. Barak could have pulled out of the war in South Lebanon was a proxy war with Syria, and Barak got cold feet before signing a peace agreement with Syria that would have required giving up all of the Golan. Ariel Sharon was not going to negotiate with Mahmoud Abbas about a peace agreement with the Palestinians before leaving Gaza, because it would have meant giving up more of the West Bank than he was willing to give up. So we pulled out without an agreement and proved, quote-unquote, to the other side, that armed struggle worked and allowed the most extreme forces to take place. We empowered the extremists on the other side by doing that. The sensible way to have pulled out of Gaza would have been as part of a negotiating process with Abbas, in which case the moderates would have gotten credit for it and diplomacy would have been legitimized. But Sharon wasn't in the least interested in doing that, because he wanted to retain over 50% of the West Bank in Israeli hands. Unfortunately, one of the results of that has been that we drastically increased the power of Hamas in Palestinian politics. I would assume that if we reached an agreement at the current moment, it would be with Abbas's government, unless we drop our objections to Palestinian reconciliation, internal reconciliation, which would be a good idea for us to do. I still don't know if it would work, because if you think Israelis and Palestinians don't get along, you have not yet seen Hamas and Fatah. But if we were to reach an agreement with Abbas regarding the future of the West Bank, it would put Hamas under tremendous political pressure, because they could either continue to rule this isolated, unrecognized territory, or they could in some way bring themselves into the agreement by rejoining, by accepting the agreement, whatever. As a political strategy, that seems to me to make the most sense. which is to negotiate with Abbas and thereby legitimize diplomacy in Palestinian eyes, and to increase the popular pressure on Hamas. I will point out, by the way, that in September of 2005, the premier Palestinian public opinion pollster, Khalil Shikaki, did a poll of the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza, and he came up with the really astounding results. The first half was not astounding at all. A large majority of the Palestinian population thought that Israel had pulled out of Gaza because of armed struggles. An equally large majority, however, was in favor of a diplomatic process in order to reach independence in the West Bank. Sharon was not willing to pursue diplomacy at that point, and that opportunity was lost. And beyond that, what can I tell you? The Palestinian leadership today in the West Bank wants to reach a peace agreement with Israel. Our refusal to do that is harming their position. Nobody influences Palestinian politics more than we do, just as nobody influences Israeli politics more than the Palestinians do. And we have the possibility to influence what goes on there by showing a greater willingness to engage in a serious diplomatic process.
In your mind, does that include the Saudi proposal? Maybe you could talk about what that is.
Well, what was originally called the Saudi proposal and then the Arab Initiative was a proposal that the Saudis put forward, and then it was approved in Beirut by the Arab League leadership in 2002, which basically said that the Arab League supported the idea of a peace agreement based on the pre-1967 lines, and that if Israel agreed to such a thing, the Arab League would be in favor of full normalization and peace with Israel. It also spoke of an agreed solution to the refugee problem, which was essentially code for the fact that it would have to be negotiated with Israel and they weren't demanding the return of every last refugee. And we never responded to that initiative. I don't think that we could have signed on the initiative word for word the way it stood, but I think that it was, let me put it this way, in 1966, the Arab world had offered that to Israel. The messianic fervor that would have broken out in Israel would have put the fervor after the Six-Day War to shame. Zionism has won. The Arab world is willing to recognize us. I'm not going to go into the details of the situation in 2002 that made it very difficult for the Israeli public to hear that. But today, we should be more willing to negotiate on that basis. It is, you know, one of the tragedies of history is that Olmert, who had finally come to that conclusion, as I said, was also under indictment for doing, everything, every economic crime that anybody could think of, and a few that I didn't even know existed until the indictment came in.
So, as we're kind of beginning to move to ending, I read you some questions, kind of, let's call them skeptically from your right. I want to ask you a question, possibly from your left, as it were. Someone says to you, okay, I understand that BDS crosses a line, but what about boycotting products from the West Bank? Why don't I do that? Why don't you in this book call for that? What do you say to someone who says that to you?
I say I don't buy products from the West Bank. However, I think that if somebody, for instance, says, I want my university to divest from Caterpillar because some of their products are used in the West Bank, but essentially what I'm saying is I want them to divest from any company that sells weapons to Israel, the medium is the message, and what they're saying is, I don't think that Israeli defense is legitimate. The message to Israelis is, I don't think Israeli military needs are legitimate. And so that's like that's a politically stupid move, because when you do that, what you do is you create a situation where Israelis circle the wagon. One of the things that most helped the settlement movement in the mid-70s was the Zionism is racism resolution in the UN. Where the Arabs won this wonderful rhetorical victory and helped bring the right to power in Israel, as well as pushing forward settlement activity. I don't have a lot of respect for posturing as a form of political protest. There's this wonderful, I would recommend very highly the documentary that it's called Between Two Worlds, is that the name of it? Kaufman and, I'm forgetting the names now.
It's Between Two Worlds.
Between Two Worlds. And there's a scene in it, I remember, of seeing this woman who's protesting outside the Israeli consulate, I think in San Francisco, and she gets arrested. And she has this look of joy on her face. She's done it. She's gotten arrested. All right, what have you done? Okay, I have no, I'm not saying that it's always, that there's no situation in which getting arrested in a political protest is a justified thing. But the point is not to be able to write home and say that you got arrested. And the point is not to be able to say, we initiated divestment just like they did during the apartheid struggle. The point is to get to political results. So I think that if you boycott products from specifically produced in West Bank settlements, the message is I'm drawing a distinction between Israel and the West Bank, which is positive. And if you boycott companies that sell goods that can be used by the Israeli military, which is a necessary and essential institution, you're sending the wrong message, and you're going to get the wrong results.
So it's 8:57. What did I not ask you that you want to talk about?
You asked everything. let's sum up here. One more question. All right, since one more question came in.
Okay. Do you have a Palestinian equivalent / colleagues? Are you friendly with Palestinian journalists who think in ways similar to the way you do?
I have. I know Palestinians who are in favor of a two-state solution. Their narrative of the conflict is different. Their sense of what's going on is different. Sense of what an agreement should conclude is different. I've met young Palestinians who are impressively in favor of nonviolent protest, who are putting forward ideas for organizing that weren't there 5 years ago. They weren't there before Tahrir Square. And I disagree with them on other things. And I'm going to say this again. If we get, God willing, to a peace agreement, the Palestinians are not going to become Zionists any more than we're going to become proponents of the Palestinian narrative. And we don't have to get there in order to have a peace agreement.
Is that the final
round? Yeah. Actually, there's one more question you didn't ask, which was, am I willing to sign books? And the answer is yes.
So two final pieces of information. Gershom's book, The Unmaking of Israel, is on sale downstairs. And I would recommend those who agree passionately and those who don't to engage with this book, which is kind of a passionate, disappointed letter to Israel from someone who has made his life there. And the second thing is, on behalf of Machon Hadar and all of us, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing your
thoughts.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.